The Hamlet Fire is the tragedy America tried to forget. On September 3, 1991, a hydraulic line ruptured at the Imperial Food Products plant in Hamlet, North Carolina, igniting cooking oil and sending toxic smoke through the facility. Workers rushed to the exits, only to find them padlocked from the outside. 25 people died and 55 were injured in what remains one of the deadliest industrial accidents in modern American history. Yet, unlike the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that transformed labor laws, the Hamlet disaster faded from public consciousness without sparking meaningful change. Bryant Simon's meticulous investigation reveals why this matters. The fire wasn't just an accident, but the predictable outcome of America's embrace of cheap as our paramount social value. The book has become required reading in labor history courses across universities, with civil rights leader Jesse Jackson calling it essential for understanding how we value and devalue human life in America. The story of Imperial Food Products begins with the transformation of chicken from occasional Sunday dinner to America's most consumed protein. Early 20th century poultry production was small-scale and local, with rural families raising handfuls of chickens primarily for eggs. These birds roamed freely, eating scraps and insects, remaining relatively thin and tough. The Cagle family exemplified the industry's evolution, starting with George L. Cagle's modest $8,000 investment in an Atlanta poultry shop during World War II when beef rationing drove chicken demand skyward. The industry changed dramatically when George's son Douglas implemented vertical integration in the 1950s, acquiring slaughterhouses, feed mills, hatcheries, and processing facilities. Rather than owning farms, Cagle's adopted the grow-out system pioneered by Jesse D. Jewell, offering struggling rural farmers contracts where the company provided chicks and feed while farmers supplied housing, equipment, and labor. What initially seemed like salvation for struggling farmers quickly became exploitation. As competition intensified, companies demanded larger birds grown faster in modernized facilities. Farmers took on mounting debt for improvements, often borrowing $100,000 or more. Those who resisted lost their contracts and ultimately their farms when they couldn't repay loans. The system thrived on monopolistic power in economically depressed rural areas where people had few alternatives. "They've got you," one farmer explained. "You borrowed all this money to build these houses. You can't do nothing else with them. And if they cut you off, you're done." By 1991, when the Hamlet Fire occurred, this system had transformed independent farmers into what critics called modern-day serfs or indentured servants, while companies like Tyson, Purdue, and Cagle's amassed unprecedented wealth and power. Have you ever wondered why today's supermarket chickens barely resemble the birds your grandparents raised? The transformation was deliberate and methodical. In 1946, A&P Supermarket sponsored the Chicken of Tomorrow contest, offering prizes for breeding the biggest birds with the largest breasts to satisfy American preference for white meat. These competitions produced increasingly top-heavy chickens resembling Barbie dolls rather than traditional barnyard fowl. Food scientists soon replaced rural tinkerers, developing methods to accelerate biological productivity through advanced housing, lighting, feeding regimens, and disease control. The results were staggering. In 1928, raising a 2.8-pound chicken took 112 days and 12.5 pounds of feed. By the 1970s, broilers were 25% larger while consuming half as much feed. By 1995, the average industrial chicken weighed over 6 pounds after just 47 days, consuming only 10 pounds of feed, a growth rate that would make a newborn human baby weigh 600 pounds by its second month. These miracle breeds, with names like Vantress and Cypress Sea, could barely walk under their unnatural weight. Growers kept lights on 20-22 hours daily to encourage constant feeding, causing severe stress that led birds to attack each other. Farmers de-beaked chickens without anesthesia and administered cocktails of drugs, Benadryl to calm nerves, caffeine to keep birds eating, antibiotics to prevent disease spread in cramped quarters, and even dyes to give skin an appealing golden hue. The McLibel case, a lengthy British trial where McDonald's sued activists, exposed this cruelty. The judge concluded that broilers spent their final days with virtually no movement space, suffering broken legs from their oversized breasts. Many died from dehydration, starvation, or heart failure, what the industry euphemistically called flip-over syndrome. This wasn't just animal cruelty, it was the first step in a system that would ultimately claim human lives as well. "I'm in pain the whole time, at work and at home," Betty Harp told a New York Times reporter in 1989, describing her job at a Kegels plant in Macon, Georgia. The repetitive motions of deboning and cutting with heavy scissors caused tendinitis and carpal tunnel syndrome. A North Carolina Department of Labor study that year found that 25% of poultry workers suffered occupational injuries, triple the rate for all private sector workers nationwide. Another Kegels employee, Jessie Lee Moss, showed the reporter scars on her wrists from surgery to treat work-related injuries. She described sharp pains that regularly drove her from bed at night, forcing her to run water over her wrists for relief. The Institute for Southern Studies estimated that 2/3 of North Carolina's chicken plant employees suffered from cumulative trauma disorders. The speed was relentless. Processing lines moved at nearly 100 birds per minute, giving workers milliseconds to perform precise cutting motions. In 1978, the Carter administration's Department of Agriculture approved chemical baths instead of manual cleaning, allowing processing speeds to increase from 70 to 100 birds per minute. This made chicken cheaper, but increased both consumer illness risk and worker injuries. Workers faced other hazards, too. Chicken catchers roughly grabbed birds by their feet and shoved them into crates, breaking bones of nearly 30% of them. During transport, chickens were soaked in their own waste. Terrified birds defecated during slaughter, contaminating the scalding baths they were dragged through to remove feathers. Fecal matter seeped into bed sores and spread during mechanical evisceration, spraying onto equipment and workers. As workers and animals suffered, chicken became America's affordable protein. Between 1950-1999, U.S. chicken production increased by 7% annually, with prices dropping dramatically. By 1990, chicken cost 1/9 the price of steak and 20% less than pork. Consumers purchased chicken without knowledge of its origins or production methods, while poultry producers found themselves trapped in a cycle of destructive competition. Robert C. Baker, a Cornell University professor nicknamed Chicken Edison, invented the chicken nugget around 1963, nearly 20 years before it appeared on McDonald's menus. Unlike the sad-ass basement worker imagined in HBO's The Wire, Baker was a respected academic who worked closely with the poultry industry. Born in 1921 on a farm in Newark, New York, Baker grew up collecting eggs and preparing chickens for Sunday dinners. After studying at Cornell, Penn State, and Purdue, he returned to Cornell in 1947 to expand its poultry science program. Baker specialized in further processed chicken, developing ways to use leftover poultry parts and scraps, believing this could increase profits while addressing world hunger problems. Baker's work helped resolve contradictions in poultry capitalism by finding ways to sell the glut of chicken produced by efficient operations. Between 1960-1980, he created over 50 further processed chicken products in his Cornell lab: chicken bologna, steak, salami, chili, hash, and pastrami. His most famous invention was the chicken nugget, inspired by fish sticks. Baker and his collaborator, Joseph Marshall, solved two engineering challenges: binding ground chicken parts without an outer skin and ensuring batter adhesion despite temperature changes. They created a clay-like mixture of ground chicken with salt, vinegar, powdered milk, grains, and sodium phosphate, then coated it in egg batter and cornflake crumbs before freezing and cooking. The texture, fat, and salt content created an almost addictive eating experience with broad taste appeal. Though Baker's Nuggets sold 1,200 boxes in their first test market, they remained relatively unknown until McDonald's independently developed Chicken McNuggets in the late 1970s. After solving the same technical challenges Baker had faced years earlier, McDonald's debuted McNuggets in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1980 to record-breaking sales. By 1983, McNuggets were available nationwide, making McDonald's the world's second-largest chicken consumer after KFC. In the inflation-plagued 1970s, as blue-collar wages declined, cheap food became essential for working families. While the poorest Americans spent nearly 30% of their income on food, working poor spent 15 to 20%, and upper-middle-class families less than 10%. Food remained one of the few fudgeable items in family budgets. Unlike fixed expenses like rent or car payments, food spending could be adjusted through buying cheaper proteins like chicken, clipping coupons, or purchasing generic products. By the 1970s, convenience trumped flavor in American kitchens. With more women working outside the home to compensate for declining wages, yet still responsible for cooking and household management, time saving became paramount. The average cooking time dropped from 2 hours daily in 1960 to less than 30 minutes by 1990, the lowest among industrialized nations. Microwave ownership jumped from under 10% of households in 1978 to nearly universal by 1998. Fast food consumption rose dramatically, with Americans spending 35% of their food budgets on eating out by 1987, compared to just 15% in 1940. By 1990, Americans consumed 15 to 20% of their total calories at fast food chains. Food marketers portrayed cooking as drudgery and convenience foods as liberation. Kentucky Fried Chicken even ran advertisements under the banner Women's Liberation. As processed foods proliferated, chicken evolved from farm animal to disembodied product, from whole birds to cut pieces to skinless, boneless breasts to further processed nuggets. McNuggets transformed American chicken consumption. By the 1990s, less than 15% of broilers were sold as whole birds. The product represented perfect industrial food. Cheap ingredients, leftover chicken parts, corn-based fillers, salt, water, no utensils required, and endless flavor variations through dipping sauces that prevented taste fatigue. Children particularly embraced nuggets, which became the hot dog of the 1990s, appearing in schools, restaurants, and grocery freezers. Emmett Roe recognized the nugget opportunity, but entered a fiercely competitive market. As factory farms expanded and processing speeds increased, the broiler industry faced cycles of overproduction and aggressive cost-cutting. Industry giants like Tyson and Perdue quickly dominated the mass market for further processed chicken products. Imperial Food Products found itself relegated to specialty niches, manufacturing customized chicken products from frozen boneless breasts for small and medium-sized southern restaurant chains. They used discarded meat for generic nuggets sold to schools and companies that sometimes rebranded them. To combat nugget fatigue, especially among adults who wanted less breading and more meat, Imperial began producing chicken tenders, 2-inch strips of white meat pulled from chicken breasts. The workers at Imperial endured harsh conditions and disrespect because they desperately needed the jobs. Georgia Quick's husband's work at the cotton gin had become unpredictable, making her steady paycheck essential. Kate Nicholson, with a 10th grade education, started at Imperial when her husband lost his textile mill job. Elizabeth Bellamy, who had fled New York City's crack epidemic and gun violence with her daughters to return south, found Imperial her only employment option. Her 19-year-old daughter, Felicia, worked alongside her. George's orientation at Imperial was brief and focused on rules rather than safety. She received no fire safety training, evacuation instructions, or information about emergency procedures. The job required standing in freezing water, pulling tendons, and scraping fat from chicken pieces. Workers wore multiple pairs of gloves and socks, but remained cold and wet throughout their shifts. The plant had high turnover due to the harsh conditions. Workers faced constant surveillance, including timed bathroom breaks, threats of termination for minor infractions, and a relentless production pace. Equipment frequently malfunctioned, providing unscheduled breaks that workers came to appreciate. Management shuffled employees between stations daily, believing this prevented repetitive motion injuries. The economic troubles facing Imperial's workers reflected a broader rural crisis. While media portrayed farm failures as primarily affecting Midwestern family farms, the crisis devastated small towns nationwide that depended on both agricultural and industrial labor. Rising interest rates, falling crop prices, and vanishing factory jobs due to global competition hollowed out communities like Hamlet. By 1990, 40% of North Carolina's rural families lived below the poverty line, with even higher rates among African Americans. Richmond County's unemployment reached 9.7%, double the rate of urban centers, and significantly worse for Black residents. As Clark equipment closed and textile mills scaled back, the economic devastation rippled through the community. The hospital, banks, churches, and local businesses closed or reduced operations. Depression, suicide, child abuse, domestic violence, and drug use increased dramatically. Crime followed economic decline, with the local newspaper reporting a steady stream of robberies, drug busts, and even murders near the Imperial plant. Social worker Cordelia Steele observed that poor minorities often lacked access to social services and mental health support, leading many to self-medicate until addiction took hold. Those with education and means fled to cities like Charlotte, Columbia, and Atlanta, creating a brain drain that further hampered the community's ability to attract better industries. The brain drain cut across Hamlet's racial and class divides. Josh Newton, from a white, upper-lower-class railroad family, never returned after attending college in 1983. Alan Mask Sr., an African-American school administrator, lamented that his two sons, who became doctors, never returned. Ain't nothing to come back to. Meanwhile, most working people remained trapped. Mike Quick's cousin Martin, whose wife Mary Alice died in the fire, wanted to leave, but felt his limited education made him afraid he couldn't make it in a city or up north. Similarly, Maddie Fairley, who worked at Imperial, told the Washington Post, "I can't get out of Hamlet," despite having discussed leaving with her husband when he lost his construction job. Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act into law in 1970, promising that every working man and woman in the nation shall have safe and healthful working conditions. The law granted broad powers to conduct unannounced inspections, formulate safety regulations, and impose penalties for violations. Union leader I.W. Abel called it a giant step forward, comparable to the Wagner Act. Yet Nixon's political calculations undermined OSHA from the start. His new federalism allowed states to form their own worker safety agencies, ostensibly upholding federal standards while remaining under state control. Southern states, like North Carolina, used this provision to do less for workers, making themselves competitive in attracting businesses fleeing stricter federal oversight elsewhere. For OSHA to work effectively, it needed what Germans call Ordnung, a careful balance between law and consequences. The system required enough inspectors making surprise visits to keep employers compliant, backed by meaningful penalties. But by 1991, OSHA employed just 1,300 inspectors for 7 million workplaces nationwide, one inspector for every 4,666 job sites. In North Carolina, the ratio was 3.5 times worse than the national average, signaling to businesses like Imperial that they could operate however they pleased. Even when violations were found, penalties were negligible. The median fine collected nationally for accidents that killed or injured workers between 1972-1990 was less than $500. In North Carolina, it was even lower at $395. OSHA's effectiveness was further undermined by its unfortunate timing, launching just as America's economic dominance was ending, with the rise of stagflation in the early 1970s. The failure of Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Carter to curb inflation and restore well-paying jobs eroded faith in government as a problem solver. As Americans faced reduced wages and surging prices, many became receptive to conservative critiques of New Deal thinking. OSHA quickly became a lightning rod in changing American attitudes about regulation. By 1972, the National Association of Manufacturers was already complaining about its massive regulations that impinged on almost every aspect of day-to-day operations. When the Imperial Fire broke out, Dobbins Heights Fire Chief Ernest Cannon immediately offered assistance, but Hamlet Fire Chief David Fuller told him to stay ready and never called. While fire departments from much farther away were summoned, Dobbins Heights remained on standby all day despite having firefighters with personal connections to Imperial workers. In a documentary interview, Ernest Cannon charged that Hamlet Fire Department's failure to call his Dobbins Heights crew was racially motivated. In the aftermath, Hamlet briefly united in grief. The city declared 30 days of mourning with flags at half-staff. Local businesses organized fundraisers, while the American Legion provided transportation services. The Salvation Army distributed clothes, and religious organizations raised over $58,000 for victims. Support came from beyond Hamlet, too, with donations from companies like Stanley Tools and churches across multiple states. Ruth DeRosa's research revealed profound trauma among survivors. Many developed self-destructive behaviors, drinking excessively, overeating, and overspending. Survivors battled shame about being portrayed as chicken thieves and survivor's guilt. One woman attempted suicide by car crash, explaining, "I was mad at the Lord for not taking my life." Many struggled with faith and inexplicable behaviors, standing frozen during emergencies, obsessively checking locks, or burning their lawns to prevent fires. The fire's trauma hit the African American community particularly hard. DeRosa's team discovered black children and adolescents showed higher PTSD levels than their white peers. This heightened trauma stemmed from pre-existing racial tensions and new injustices. Some black survivors felt white workers received larger relief funds and better job opportunities at employment fairs. As a black woman, Annette Zimmerman believed, they only thought I could cook or clean. Most Imperial survivors channeled their anger into litigation rather than violence, hoping the courts would provide moral justice. They wanted the Rose to pay financially and face imprisonment. As psychologist Joesta Cadell reported, victims repeatedly said things like, "When I get my money, that's when justice will be served," and "They will pay, and then they will have nothing." In March 1992, a grand jury indicted Emmett Rowe, Brad Rowe, and James Hare on 25 counts of involuntary manslaughter, each carrying a maximum 10-year sentence. Emmett hired Joseph Cheshire V, North Carolina's premier defense attorney known as the Dealmaker. When Cheshire met with District Attorney Carol Lauder, he discovered the prosecutor held deeply racist views of the victims, reportedly saying, "They were just a bunch of low-down black folks anyway." In September 1992, Emmett Rowe accepted a plea agreement, receiving a sentence of 19 years and 11 months with parole possible in under 5 years. All charges against Brad Rowe and James Hare were dropped. Assistant DA David Graham told the press, "Emmett Rowe ran the plant as a dictator. He personally made the decision to padlock the door." Victims' families expressed outrage at the leniency. After the fire, Imperial faced over 100 lawsuits alleging gross, willful, and wanton negligence. While most victims had modest financial hopes of paying off debts and escaping poverty, some dreamed of wealth that would transform their lives. The North Carolina Department of Labor cited Imperial for 83 violations and fined the company a record $808,150, which Emmett Rowe called simply absurd and claimed he couldn't pay. By August 1992, Rowe declared bankruptcy, claiming banks had seized $600,000 from his accounts after the fire. With Imperial bankrupt, lawyers turned to the company's insurers, who initially resisted but eventually agreed to pay $16.1 million to 100 claimants. Wrongful death settlements ranged from $175,000 to $1 million, while injury cases received between $2,500 and $1.13 million. A subsequent lawsuit against 41 companies that allegedly contributed to the disaster resulted in $24 million in damages, with victims ultimately receiving $35,000 to $70,000 each after legal fees. The Hamlet Fire represents America's fundamental shift toward cheap as the solution to social problems. This ideology created a vulnerable working poor as the largest segment of the American working class, drove industrial migration to rural areas where workers couldn't organize, and diminished faith in government. Workers like Goodwin remained silent about hazards, knowing they were expendable in a system that had cut public assistance to benefit business. The paradox of American food abundance emerged. Unhealthy calories became cheap for consumers, but were produced by frenzied, exploited workers. Cheap wasn't just a business strategy, but a new social imagining that replaced New Deal ideals with individual choice and personal outcomes. This ideology, embraced by both parties, swept away union protections and regulatory oversight in favor of reduced prices. While food costs dropped 18% during the Clinton years compared to Reagan's, the real costs were hidden. Farm subsidies, food stamps for underpaid workers, environmental cleanup, health care for obesity-related illnesses, and workplace injuries. The cheap state operated behind the scenes while maintaining the rhetoric of free trade and individual choice. Despite national attention after the Hamlet Fire, reforms were minimal. 6 months later, survivors struggled to find work, with some returning to dangerous poultry plants. Line speeds increased, injury rates hit 19-year highs, and immigrant workers replaced locals, creating an even more vulnerable workforce. Republican politicians soon attacked overregulation, and even Democrats like Clinton avoided workplace safety as a campaign issue. Similar tragedies continue worldwide, as seen in the 2013 Chinese poultry plant fire that killed 120 people and the Bangladeshi factory collapse that killed over 1,000. With her lawsuit settlement, Loretta Goodwin paid off debts and purchased a modest 1950s bungalow. 20 years after the fire, she remains deeply traumatized. Once an active walker, she now stays home with the shades drawn, suffering from breathing difficulties, leg pain, and memory issues. Like her town and the country at large, Goodwin remains trapped by the same system of cheap that caused the tragedy of September 3, 1991. She continues telling her story, hoping that someday no one will ever again have to die to work.